Good morning, everyone. The objective of this session is to provide you with an update on the new insurance contract standard, IFRS 17, the tentative decision that the board made in November, and the next steps. To assist in the discussion, we have prepared a presentation under Agenda Paper 7. Because the papers for the meeting today have been posted before the November board meeting, the summary of the tentative decision made by the board in November is not included in this presentation. And as noted on slide 6, the summary is available in the November ISP update. I will briefly comment on the presentation under Agenda Paper 7, and I will then summarize the recent decisions on two key topics: the level of aggregation and the transition requirements. So starting from slide 2, this timeline shows what has been happening on the project since we issued the second exposure draft in June 2013. In February this year, the board gave permission to the staff to start drafting the new standard. And based on a preliminary draft of the standard, between August and October, we invited some insurance companies and individuals, as mentioned on slide 3 of the presentation, to test the wording in the standard. This testing with preparers supplements the external review that is now being performed by standard setters, regulators, and audit firms. The objective of the testing was to obtain evidence about how companies will interpret specific requirements and about any operational difficulty identified by companies in applying the new requirements. We asked feedback on 6 topics that are listed in slide 4 and 5. The board discussed the result of the testing in November and reconsider some of its previous decisions on the basis of the feedback received. In particular, the board rediscussed the requirements to aggregate contracts and the transition requirements. Regarding the level aggregation, many test participants noted that the requirement to group contracts with similar profitability and risk resulted in a very high number of groups of contracts that would require excessively granular calculations. So in November, the board expressed sympathy for the concern about the relative benefits and cost of the level of aggregation that was described in the external testing draft. And the board adopted an approach that would balance the need for transparent information about the effect of changes in estimates in the financial statement with lower operational costs. That revised approach would require an entity to firstly identify its portfolio of contracts and then group onerous contracts at inception separately from contracts that are not onerous at inception. In particular, the entity will divide each portfolio into 3 groups: a group of contracts that are onerous when firstly recognized, if any; a group of contracts that at initial recognition have no significant risk of becoming onerous, if any; and a group of the remaining contracts in the portfolio. Each group of contracts will include only contracts issued in the same year. Regarding transition, the board decided to revise the simplified approach that would be used when the full retrospective application of IFRS 17 is impracticable, and to permit entities to choose between a new modified retrospective approach and the fair value approach in those situations. The new modified retrospective approach reflects the board's view that entities should be permitted to use reasonable and supportable information that is available to them if it provides a closer approximation to retrospective application than that would be the case under the simplified approach. The recent decisions of the board have already been reflected in an updated draft of IFRS 17 that is currently subject to the external review of selected parties, including the major accounting firms, regulators, and the member of the International Forum of Accounting Standard Setters. The plan is then to publish the final standard in March 2017. In the light of the imminent publication of the standard, the board also agreed at its November meeting that the effective date of IFRS 17 would be for annual periods beginning on or after the 1st of January 2021. And with that, I would hand over to the forum for the discussion.
I've been directly involved in this field testing, and wow, I thought I was a tough guy, but this is, from an operational point of view, it's very, very, very demanding. It's amazing how much it's changed. So, I strongly stress two points, I believe. It's the aggregation, it's an aggregation by risk. I really believe that doesn't make much more sense than aggregating by profitability or any other measure, because companies are not managed on that sense. Really, I believe the level of risk and how the risk interacts is the way that the companies are actually managed. So this other levels of aggregation, and at least our experience, didn't provide any useful managerial or and I don't believe it would be interesting to disclose this information too. So I believe that aggregation by risk is exactly. The other is customer service margin. And the small adjustments, and I don't know what's going to be the next your next steps on that, but some adjustments are due to error, really, and some adjustments are due to things that happen economically after, for example, commissions paid after you calculated it initially, and they do not come according to your original expectation. And if you cannot adjust the customer service margin, you end up having a very stable number, of course, but then all the fluctuations on those numbers go into P&L. And I don't know if you end up not reaching by a very specific point the problem that you were trying to avoid in the first place, which is recognize the customer service margin explicitly, and which is actually the earning power of the company, really. It's a very welcome change. But if any change you do that after, you go straight to P&L and keep the customer service margin a fixed number, I don't know if it ends up being very artificial. And the significant variation comes through those extra miles. So I'm not sure it is the best way to see the actual result and let the customer service margin vary a little bit, which is not would not be the more economically meaningful actually number. So I'm not convinced. Looking at the numbers after, say, well, we're going to see this flat line over time, but do you really believe this flat line over time? It's just if you should to.
Are you worried that the line will be too flat, or?
No, there are two approaches here. You adjust the customer service margin after you write the policy, and it keeps fluctuating a little. And the other approach, no, it is going to be flat line, and every other adjustment, you're going to call it errors, or it can be error, a real error, or it can be just changes in estimates, like commissions that you pay after. And those will go directly to P&L but not affecting the customer service margin. Is the main point, isn't it?
So I think possibly it's because I see where you're coming from in taking essentially two extreme options.
Yeah.
I think essentially where the board has landed is in a space in between that. So if something has actually occurred that is different to your expectations, it goes through profit and loss because you have now determined that the estimates that you've made in the past have been proven by facts to be wrong, and so you take that effect. But if you have changes in your future expectations, what you expect will happen in the future, so if we term a change in estimate, then that would unlock CSM and cause a change in CSM. So CSM will fluctuate as you change your determination.
I understand. This is very hard to distinguish these two changes in my expectations that prove to be wrong, and because we're talking about a long-term insurance policy sometimes here,
yep.
and the way I see the future is going to change. So
a change in future estimates, even if it comes for whatever reason that it comes about, if it's a change in my future expected cash flows and affects only those future expected cash flows, it goes through CSM.
I understand that, but take a mortality rate, for example. So I am wrong because I estimate 4%, and then next year that's 4.2%, or is my expectation about the future changing, which is now it's 4.5%, but it's just 4.5% because I saw 4.2% happening at the moment. So, and it maybe is our fault in to implement it, but this was not really clear.
I think it is perhaps important. Maybe there's two things to emphasize here. I think what you're saying, the confusion about when you switch from the one to the other, was something I think that was identified during the testing process. And as a consequence, one of the decisions that was taken in November was to make that line cleaner, so there's a clearer understanding of when you move on.
Okay. So maybe it's not.
I think it's a valid point that it was definitely raised in the testing process as something that people identified.
Yeah, because it's very easy to discuss this in a table like this, but it's very hard to implement that on insurance by insurance policies. And if you do that on a retail base, you have 20 million insurance policies, and how do you change it exactly?
Cedric.
First of all, thank you. My apologies for Patrick, who had to leave for the Financial Stability Board relating meeting in Paris. So this afternoon, so I have to talk. I will talk on his behalf. As the moving target seems to reach a stabilization stage and before final decision on insurance. We would like to share some key concerns. The first one is the level of aggregation of insurance contract, i.e. the determination of group under the draft standard terminology. ANC defines mutualization as the relationship to risk transfer accepted by a policyholder when he or she joins population, i.e. when he or she subscribes to an insurance contract. The premium may be different from the one policyholder to another because of certain characteristics of each policyholder. But once into the population, each policyholder benefits from the same guarantees. In other words, each policyholder joins a population, the boundary of which is defined by the contract proposed by the insurer, and therefore accepts to pool the premium paid with the one paid by the other in order to mutualize the cost of risk within the population. Of course, if the cost exceeds premium, the insurer will bear the excess and the population will be onerous. As a consequence of this definition of mutualization, which reflects what is happening in practice and policyholders' understanding and acceptance, group cannot be determined in too granular a way because this would destroy the fully accepted mutualization. In fact, a top-down approach is probably to be considered based upon the concept of portfolio. This is to be discussed. Paragraph 19 raises also a key concern since it seems to prohibit intergenerational mutualization in open portfolios, which is currently a fact. The second concern is the release of the CSM on the basis of passage of time. A linear system is probably reasonable for short-term policies, for instance, in the area of property and casualty insurance. For long-term insurance, in particular, with a significant investment component, we have a real doubt. It requires at least clarification, and such a clarification needs to demonstrate that, in such cases, there is no anticipation of profit as compared to current practice. Should it be the case, we believe it would not be a good solution. In this context, the notion of coverage unit needs to be clarified. The third concern is related to the scope of the variable fee approach. Direct participative contracts are a strong trend, and there are many ways to put that in place. Therefore, economic, financial substance, and constructive commitment need to complement a restrictive contractual approach if the standard wants to ultimately reflect reality. The fourth concern is related to the relationship between IFRS 9 and IFRS 17. As expressed before, the congruence of assets and liabilities is for a number of portfolio a key goal. Both standards should be consistent and not create mismatches in addition to the ones management has not eliminated through appropriate asset management. The fifth concern is on transition. As far as we can see at this stage, the measure of future performance could be significantly affected, in particular if the above-mentioned CSM release issue is not addressed. Finally, the sixth, there are other concerns that just need to be mentioned at this stage, hedging, experience adjustment, and so on. Again, it's simply mentioned at this stage, so sorry for having for read. It's important to fix that.
I think the concerns that you raise are concerns that we've been aware of. They're concerns that have come up during the outreach process leading up to the standard, and the board's considered each of these concerns either before developing the external testing draft or in the sweep issues that we discussed in the November meeting. I think it's also worth making the point that the standard itself doesn't prohibit any action on the company's part. What it does, it seeks to do, is it seeks to reflect the gains and losses that appear as a result of things like intergenerational transfer or not. And I think some of the changes that the board made, that Roberta mentioned in the realm of level of aggregation and then transition, should go quite some way to address a lot of the concerns you raise, albeit it isn't exactly what different people want exactly as they've expressed it. So I think it will be interesting when you, I think you're all participating in the next stage of the external review, to see the extent to which we've managed to clarify that and whether our position is in fact clear.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Generally, the ESC members think that the tentative decisions made at the ISB meeting in November properly reflect the feedback provided by various interested parties. However, a few AOC members think that the requirement to divide contracts into annual cohorts is not principle-based and could result in a granular level of aggregation. In addition, the constituents of one jurisdiction think that it is not clear from the tentative decision how the effect of mutualization in different cohorts would be accounted for. They require the ISB to clarify how the effect of mutualization in different cohorts would be accounted for. Thank you.
I think, and it also came a little bit in Cedric's comments, that it's clear that what we have decided to characterize as the mutualization that we're willing to take into consideration in how contracts, groups of contracts are measured, is not necessarily the same as the way that the term is used by different people, because different companies use that term in very different ways. And we distinguish mutualization, where we see as a risk sharing, in a way that the entity, the shareholder, is not affected, as different from cross-subsidization or other forms of sort of price transfer, if you like to put it that way. The question on the cohorts came about really because I think what the board has decided in allowing companies to group contracts into essentially three groups is it works from a capturing the recognition of appropriate onerous contracts type situation, but would not go far enough in allowing for the contractual service margin to be recognised in the right period. So we had seen the cohort idea as being the the sort of counterbalance to the concessions the board has made in terms of trying to balance the operationality with the right sort of information that should be portrayed by the financial statements when the standard is applied.
Yukio.
Thank you. Our technical committee of insurance contract discussed the tentative decision made by the IASB and observed that some of the important issues, including aggregation that were raised in the external testings, were resolved. We expect that the final standard would appropriately reflect the drafting issues that were raised in the external testing. In particular, we are focusing on how the effect of mutualization in different cohorts could be appropriately drafted.
Linda.
Thank you. So I want to just comment on the fact that we think that the field testing exercise was very worthwhile. And to basically say that if you have decided as a board that you've done enough field testing and you've made decisions as a result of that, that at some point you need to move on. The standard's been under development for a very long time. I think it's very important that you communicate with a lot of transparency how you arrived at those final decisions, and I'm assuming that in time that will come, which is fine. If you concluded that that you had other issues, then you would have to do more field testing, but I get the sense that you're happy with the field testing, and you have set an effective date of 2021. So it means that people need to get on with it, and we need to get the final standard. I think that's very important. So I have the commitment of the three largest insurers in Canada that they are satisfied, that they are willing to move forward. We recognize that because we had a lot of current value principles already in the Canadian system, that this may not be as big a change for us as it is for other jurisdictions. And I think that that's where the ISB has to be sure that they're monitoring implementation issues very closely. This is a very complicated standard, and for some jurisdictions it's a very major change. So the ability to monitor those issues and make sure that those issues are getting resolved, I think, is very important. And the only other comment I have is that we are working very hard on the fatal flaw, but to do that without the basis is somewhat challenging. So that is a bit of a limitation in terms of the fatal flaw review.
I think it would be interesting for us to understand which aspects of the standard you're finding it difficult to understand.
Sure.
With the basis, because the standard needs to stand on its own, and the basis doesn't have authoritative, and that's part of why when we do a fatal flaw review, we generally don't circulate the basis.
So we will be sure to add that to our commentary.
Tommaso.
Thank you. First of all, I want to echo what Linda said. I mean, we're working hard on the further flow, and it's difficult to really understand everything without the whole picture. So, basis for conclusions, also transitions, so are still missing, maybe useful. I want to comment on the approach for aggregation of contracts. We are now studying and understanding the new approach decided in the last meeting of the ISB. My point of view is our point of view is that the way you're grouping contracts within the new approach may create some big concerns, especially because the grouping, the contracts are grouped individually. So the contract into the group of onerous contract, into the group of contracts that may become onerous and other contracts, is made contract by contract. Whilst I understood that for commercial reasons and often for regulatory reasons, insurance companies price their contracts as a whole rather than contract by contract. So maybe in a group with the same risk, there may be some contracts that are onerous and others that are not, but because they have to do it or for commercial reason or for regulatory reason. So in this context, I do not see why some contracts should be considered onerous and not. There are other circumstances in the IFRS in which, for regulatory reason, you made a sort of exception to the general principle. I remind the case of IFRS 9, in which, if you have frequent sales, but because of to meet regulatory objective, you do not consider as in determining the business model, no?
That's not true. We specifically say that it's not relevant, that you wouldn't think about it differently just because it's required by a regulator.
Yeah, it wouldn't affect because you do for regulatory reason. So anyway, I think that these circumstances, I do not see merits for recognize some contracts as onerous in such sales. Another point is on the new model. I see that one of the concerns were that the outcome should not be to have too many groups. I understand grouping by year, understand grouping by risk, and by level of risk of becoming onerous of the contract. But then grouping by year may determine a large number of groups being created. I also some comments on the wording on these groups, but we can probably give you feedback on the response to the fatal flaw on that. Another point is on mutualization. I understood that the staff and the SB is working on this concept also in the standard. My question is how this concept would interfere with this the level of aggregation, and if it would it should be clear in the standard. I would not expect to have this concept outside the new standard in such guide, some guidance outside the standard. I think everything should be in the same document.
Do you think it's missing from the draft that you've got as part of the external review, or have you not yet managed to explore that?
I had a really quick look because I received.
Okay, so I think maybe when you've had a chance to look
in my search, there wasn't this concept of mutualization, but probably I need to go in the details and maybe. But it should be clear, no? If there's a concept of mutualization, I think that it should be clear and it should be clear how to apply.
The cash flows, yes, it should be clear within the cash flow.
That's my point.
Yes. Okay. We think that we've already augmented the section on mutualization in the draft that you have.
Darrell.
A couple of things. Maybe right up front, I think it is worth us saying and repeating what we said before, which is that the companies that participated in the testing process did so with a lot of detail, gave us a lot of information. They really did put a lot of work into the testing process, and it was a very useful feedback that we got through the process. And I think that's the point. So a general, to the extent that this is a public forum, thanks to the companies that did do that work, and we accept and appreciate that they put a lot in. I think it's been quite useful to hear that a number of the points that have been raised around the table here reflect very similar points to what we heard through the testing and what we responded to, I think, in the November meeting. So I think that's helpful as well. I think it is also really worthwhile bearing in mind that the objective of the test was to test whether there were operational issues. The objective of the test was not to see whether or not people had different views on the outcome of some things. And I think we've accepted throughout the process that however we issue the standard and whenever we issue the standard, it is going to change practice in a number of jurisdictions. And we've heard the comment, I think, on fairly frequent occasions that this is not how we do business right now, this is not how we report the business right now. I think we've accepted that that is a consequence of adopting a new standard, and that's what's going to come out of the process. One or two other things. I think that the level of aggregation is certainly, based on what we heard, the wording that we've changed now will mean that you will get a lot less generic representation of aggregation than what people had assumed reading our words previously. But simultaneously, I think you will get a lot more generic than what is currently the case. Many insurers measure at a very high level at the moment, and we believe that is inappropriate for A, the representation of things like commercial activities like deliberately writing loss-making business, which in every industry we think is important to highlight, or trends over time, either more profitable or less profitable over time, which we think is important to represent. And that was one of the points I thought was useful, is just listening to the word mutualization. And I think what one of the things that we've suffered throughout this project is the fact that there is not a common international global definition applied to certain words. So we use a word like mutualization, and we know what we mean by mutualization. Cedric has just given a definition of mutualization, which differs a little bit from the way we think about it. And so to Andrew's point earlier, I think we have, and I'm trying to remember the last draft I saw, but I think we have avoided using the word mutualization in the standard, and that is by design, because mutualization has a ready pre-understood meaning. And putting that word into the standard would have led people down the path that they expect rather than necessarily the path that we've defined. So when you look for mutualization, look for it under the description of what it is. It's a cash flow measurement recognition thing. Don't look for it under that specific word.
Stephen? I was going to make a comment about mutualization as well, because this has been a real difficult area. Because the way Cedric used it, pooling premiums and they pay claims to some people that suffer a loss and others get nothing because they don't suffer a loss, that is the whole essence of the whole standard. Right. So the word doesn't appear, but the whole standard's about it. So my concern is that people will say, oh, you're not doing mutualization, according to that definition, but it's all about that. It's about the law of large numbers, and it's about probability weighting, so it's inherent in the whole document. Now, we've talked about mutualization, but in a different way, which is the transfer between policyholders. And by us sort of using the word in that narrow context, people have then said, oh, well, you're not doing mutualization properly because insurance is about mutualization. So we've ended up now with trying to avoid using the word to avoid the confusion. But my concern is that by taking the word out, you're going to say, oh, this standard's no good because it doesn't deal with mutualization.
I think that the point is rather to say that we do not consider going at such a level of detail, meaning the transfer from one policyholder to the other one, but rather considering that when a price is defined for a newcomer in the policy, then we define a specific price based on the characteristic of the newcomer, and then he or she comes in a pool, where in that pool will be put forward to the next year and consider as a unit of account, to say, and we do not follow each and one contract and margin within that pool.
Are you talking about the fulfillment cash flow calculation or the accounting for the CSM? Because in the fulfillment cash flows, it doesn't matter on the level of aggregation. And for CSM accounting, we need to make sure that the right CSM gets into the right period.
I understand.
And that's really what the whole thing is about.
I understand your concern, and that's probably why the paragraph 19 popped up with that. But that's exactly the point where we struggle at the moment, because I don't think that it is the current practice, and it is easy to identify the CSM. Not possible to consider an open contract in a policy in such a situation, because a newcomer in the policy will have to be in a new population with a new CSM, and you cannot consider an open portfolio in such a case. So that's the point where we struggle.
You cannot consider an everlasting portfolio with newcomers subsidizing old contracts.
My understanding is that the current management is to consider that there is a pool, and you consider a newcomer in comparison to that pool, define the price to pay to come in that pool, and then when it is in the pool, it receives the same benefit as the other one. But the question is rather how to define the price of the newcomer rather than follow each and every cash flow from policyholder.
But I think you're then thinking in mutualization the way in which we have been, where there's the sharing, everybody joins the pool and then shares in the pool.
Yeah.
And that is dealt with by the specific provisions that are in the standard.
In a limited way, because you have to split it year after year, and there are many, many constraints which do not exist today in the management.
Which is by design, because we think if you don't do that, then the P&L isn't going to mean much.
Yeah. So to the extent that they are contractual provisions that there is a sharing, we reflect that. To the extent there isn't, we don't think that's different from other industries, and so that is not accommodated in the model. You get what you get out of there. When the contracts are grouped, then we don't require individual contract tracking. Once they're grouped, the group continues in the CSF, and the group is what matters. But in grouping contracts, we have imposed safeguards to make sure that we get some of our objectives about the appropriate recognition of losses and the appropriate recognition of this contractual service margin in the right period. So we have taken some elements of what people do today, but we felt the need to impose some safeguards because we understand that the accounting that that exists today for insurance contracts is not considered to be best practice, and that's partly why we're doing, well, largely why we're doing this project.
It just shows that what currently is practice in the insurance industry is just totally forbidden for other parts of the economy, like the practice of subsidizing loss-giving contracts with newcomers that you can charge more for, which is deeply ingrained in the thinking of many insurers, but it's not proper accounting. You never actually get a good insight in the actual profitability of a company that way.
The whole system of confronting premiums received today with sinisters of contracts done in the past is absurd. It only exists on insurance.
Yes, and that's why we have to put cohorts in it that don't extend beyond 1 year.
Right, it's the worst accounting system in place.
But unfortunately, it's deeply ingrained. And
Yeah,
but you know, I it's not almost over. It's never over. Chris.
I thought I should perhaps try and introduce a slightly more positive note to the conversation.
Thank you.
Just to say our insurers in Australia are happier with where you've landed on aggregation, so thank you very much for listening to all the feedback. I think that's certainly been a helpful approach. We do still have a couple of other questions and whatever else, but we don't see any of those as deal breakers.
Okay. All right, I think we are done. Let's take a break until 1:15.